I guess we might as well get started. Looks like most everyone here that's going to be here. Tonight, we're going to hear the talk bit by Hart Landsberg, who is an economics professor at Lewis and Clark College. He came and spoke to us back in May, a wonderful forum on the labor union movement, the labor movement, in South Korea. And we asked him if he wouldn't come back and fill us in on China, because China, of course, for most of us, is a pretty unknown place, especially since it's been going through a tremendous restructuring. That is something that is happening very rapidly, and of course we see the impacts by the outsourcing of jobs, the importing of all kinds of so-called cheap commodities from China, but pretty much I think they're being sold at the same price as things that were manufactured in this country, but somebody's making a huge profit on the manufacture of commodities in China. And, of course, our trade deficit has been going through the roof. And all of this, you have a feeling, I think, that it's just beginning. And, of course, China is not alone. Also in that area, of course, is India, which is going kind of through a similar process, although it didn't have a non-capitalist beginning or starting point before the recent restructuring. And so after we have a bit of a talk by Martin, then we'll have a question and answer, and I think it'll be very enlightening. So thank you, Martin.
Oh, my pleasure, and thanks for being here. I think Gary kind of framed things well. China is this huge force in not only in terms of the kind of history that China itself has had in terms of the struggles for socialism, but now as an economic force in the world. In fact, China is considered to probably be one of the most, if not the most successful, now developing countries of all time. And it's probably with the United States the country that's sort of driving the world economic system. And what's really interesting to me is that people on both the left and the right are tending to embrace China, what's happened particularly since the 1978 reforms. There's a very interesting dynamic that's going on. On the left, there's sort of two groups. One group that says that China's post-1978 reforms, which introduced marketization and everything and became what the Chinese government called market socialism, that China's great success shows that market socialism works. And they are advocating for other countries to follow this. I've been in Cuba, and there are Cuban economists who argue very much that Cuba needs to follow market socialism to grow fast. There are within South Africa in the progressive movement, in Brazil in the Workers' Party there, very strong factions of people, organizers, economists, who are saying China demonstrates that market socialism works. There are others who don't consider it socialist, but they still embrace it and say it shows that there are alternatives to neoliberalism, that China, because of its strong state and its controls, shows that neoliberalism, the free market, you know, isn't the answer, and they rally around China for those reasons. Then at the very same time, you have the World Bank and the IMF and conservative economists who are also claiming China is this wonderful economic success. And it shows that if a country opens itself up to foreign capital and reorients its activity to exports, that anybody can grow. And China is a model showing the virtues of this form of development. So it gets kind of strange when you have both sides kind of, you know, laying these sort of overlays on the experience. And the question is, well, what do we make of this experience? What do we make of the fact that people on the left and the right are both embracing it? And I think depending how we understand, or I guess what makes studying China so important is because I think it says a lot about how we understand what socialism is, how we understand what dynamics of capitalism are, and how, just to connect to what Gary said in introducing this, how we understand all this says a lot about how we try and respond to what are all these growing economic tensions where, because of China's huge export offensive, workers in Mexico, workers in Korea, workers in the United States, all over are feeling the pressure from all these exports. And how we respond to this and respond to Chinese workers becomes very important. So what I want to do is try and touch on a lot of these things. I mean, there are many topics in all of, you know, talks in each of these topics. But first, let me give you some conclusions or some perspectives about where I stand, and then to go through this in more detail. The first is, I think capitalism has been restored in China. I'm sorry to say it, but I think it's true. And while I think that there are some competitive differences and tensions between the Chinese elite and the U.S. elite, and some of these differences and tensions have proved helpful to the Venezuelan government or the Cuban government or the Brazilian government, and I hope those governments are able to use those tensions for good purposes, the sad fact is that the Chinese elite are clearly supporting a process of development within China that's antagonistic and opposes any really alternative to capitalism within China. And the fact that so many progressives look to China and see it as progressive and see it as market socialist in one form or another is very worrying and suggests that some of the problems within the left movement in terms of sort of truly understanding what it is I think we should be trying to build. In saying that capitalism has been restored, I don't want to romanticize the pre-1978 period. I think what happened there in terms of the revolution laid the groundwork for moving towards socialism, although there were many, many problems there. But in fact, that movement, whatever possibilities in a direct sense existed, were halted and have been reversed since 1978, leading to the restoration of capitalism. Second, even if one says, okay, China isn't socialist, grant you that, is there still this successful model? And I think that it's not a model that's worth defending, even if one wasn't supportive of socialism. I think the growth process there is very unstable and is very exploitative. There's no doubt that wealth is being generated, but it's not being shared with the working people of China, much less the working people elsewhere. And Chinese working people, I don't know, you know, we talk about loss of jobs in this country, like 3 million manufacturing jobs in the last 5 or 6 years. China has lost 15 million manufacturing jobs over the same period. There's tremendous poverty, tremendous environmental destruction, tremendous exploitation going on there. Chinese working people are not benefiting from this process. Third point to make is that I don't think you can understand China's growth and development divorced from the wider capitalist system. I mean, China has benefited from crises and struggles in other countries, and its rise is intensifying the crises and struggles in other countries. In many ways, what's powering China is all this foreign investment, which is now fleeing South Korea and Mexico and the United States, creating problems. To sort of highlight this as some kind of model means that, you know, we're not really understanding combined and uneven development and seeing what's happening in China in sort of a broader context, as if everything is just this national process that can be recreated somehow. And the last sort of concluding point, and then I want to step back and kind of provide some context for all this, is that we often tend to look at the Chinese working class as a very passive mass that kind of gets moved this way under Mao and is now moved this way under Deng Xiaoping or the followers, and that really isn't true. There were many struggles within China under Mao of workers demanding independent trade unions and control over production. And there are many struggles going on in China now that we don't hear very much about. In fact, these struggles are now, where for many years were mostly laid off state workers, we're now talking about actual strikes among workers who are producing export goods for foreign capital. According to the Chinese government's own statistics, which are always underplaying this, in 2003, there were 58,000 industrial conflicts, which means two or more people involved in an actual conflict. I don't mean just a mediation. Last year, the number went up to 74,000. So that's like 200 a day, right, are going on. And you have all sorts of things of young, often women using text messaging, developing their own organizing networks. Whole cities. I was just reading yesterday about workers from 10 factories in one locale all going out supporting each other. There's a lot of activity going on, which is still very limited, still isn't connected, But again, we would make a serious mistake if we didn't see the Chinese working class as active participants in trying to resist what's going on. So let me talk a little bit about the period before the reforms, because we have to sort of figure out, I think, why, if things were progressing in a certain direction, did the 78 period come about and the reforms reverse things? What can we learn from that? And I want to say a little bit about the pre-78 period, a little bit about the slippery slope that meant that market socialism, even if it was seriously tried, couldn't succeed, that it's not a stable social formation at all. And then I want to just focus on China and the world economy and why what's going on in China is so unstable, what it looks like, what it means for working people in the United States, and so on and so forth. So let me do quickly China before 78. Some of this is very obvious, so I'm not going to spend much time on it. But under Mao, China had a particular strategy for building socialism. It was one of heavy industry. It was one of highly centralized planning of economic activity, state ownership, and very strong party control over political life and cultural life. And a number of things were achieved, ending foreign domination of the country, ending feudal relations in the countryside, achieving full employment, providing basic security, social security, and generalized equality for working people, all very important. But there were lots of costs and lots of limits to the gains. Obviously, the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution were periods of enormous sort of instability. And all through this period, from the very beginning in 1949, working people who were part of the revolution had demanded and thought they were going to have aspects of worker control, that they were in fact going to be in a situation where they were going to be making decisions about how production was going to organize and so on and so forth. And from the very beginning, the party was not willing to support that. There were major strike waves in 1949 to 52. There were strike waves from 56 to 57. There were strike waves 66 to 67 in the heart of the Cultural Revolution. There was another major explosion in 1976. Again, this is not a passive Chinese working class. And when this happened, Mao basically took what the All China Federation of Trade Unions, which had sort of struggles going on, what should it be like, and really imposed very tight party control such that it was no longer really an instrument helping workers. And workers in all these strike waves were trying to build autonomous unions, find ways to make connections, were very influenced by struggles in other Eastern European countries and things like that. So I guess the point is that when Mao died in 1976, the Chinese people had gained a lot, but there was a lot that they still wanted and felt hadn't really been part of what was going on. And so it was a very important moment to stop and say, well, how do we build on the successes? How do we build on the strengths? How do we go further? Deng Xiaoping, who was a member of the party, had been criticized by Mao for being a capitalist rotor during the Cultural Revolution, rebuilt his position, and I think the fact that he could was a sign of one of the problems of how Mao understood building socialism, and that was the enormous control over the party. Once Deng Xiaoping got a hold of the party, he was in a position to transform the entire social relations of the country without having to engage with debates about the experience of the Mao period, without having to debate about alternatives. And even during the Cultural Revolution, this is a very complicated period with a lot of very positive things that happened, which are not usually addressed anymore, but it was a period where Mao and Deng Xiaoping's sides were fighting over the party and its control. Deng Xiaoping wanted very disciplined managerial control over production. Mao didn't want that. He wanted the party to control and shape things ideologically. Mao's side was not for unions. Lots of, you know, overtime, lots of, you know, everybody, you know, get involved. The independent working class movement was trying to say, you know, if we're going to work overtime, we want to have control over production. If we're really the masters of things, we want to have unions that are responsive to us. And the two sides of the party that were fighting, we're not fighting to create a party that would create a basis for workers to do things. They were fighting for the sort of soul of the party and the direction of the country. And when Mao lost and Deng Xiaoping won, because the party was so powerful, Deng Xiaoping could make changes without having to address working class needs, without having to engage in any kinds of debates with people or open things up. So part of the limitations all through the Mao period was Mao's unwillingness to kind of use the party to build capacities among the working class, but to try and hold control. When he lost control, we can see what could happen. Deng Xiaoping said, the problem with China is that Mao was messing around with too many socialist ideas, and that it was premature historically to try to build a new society. You had to build forces of production. China had to get more developed. When it got more developed, then we could try and have worker control. We can talk about all these things. Until China is rich, impossible. And the only way to make China rich is to use the market. You need markets for efficiency, investment, production, and then someday there'll be socialism. And the process will be guaranteed because we, the party, will be in charge, and we'll use our state ownership to make sure. It's very important to note that nobody in the country at that time was saying that the market was what we need to make a better China. There were calls for other things, but Deng Xiaoping never legitimated any open debates. He said we're going to move towards the market, and he argued that we had to do that because China had been this disaster. Everything was no good. That the only way we could move forward is with the market. The fact is that China had grown very, very fast industrially. Even during the era of the Cultural Revolution, it had grown like 10% a year in terms of industry. Even though agriculture hadn't done so well, or nearly as well, productivity was much higher than in India, most of the other countries in similar levels of development. So it was far from kind of a basket case that it was presented. But again, Deng Xiaoping didn't have to engage in any kind of debates about this. He just sort of said, this is what we're going to do. And with the control of the party, he was able to make a move to increase the market and say that things would be solved that way. So let's talk about that. His argument, again, was, well, we've got to have more flexibility. Too much central planning. We've got to get richer, and the market will do this. And he argued that market socialism was going to be the answer. And the way I see it is that the reform process that he introduced was sort of began a slippery slope that very quickly took what might have been a serious attempt to make market socialism into capitalist restoration pretty quickly. And although there are people who were involved in that, who probably had that as an end goal, I think there were many people in the party who really hoped that there could be some other way of building socialism and were sort of open to thinking about the role the market could have. And that's why I think it's very important that we sort of try and understand what this process was that led from the state attempt at socialism to what I think is the restoration of capitalism. How did it happen? And the argument I'm going to make is that this reform process went through three waves. And each wave was kind of triggered by contradictions and tensions in what preceded it. So that even though there were some people who really thought that they might be able to make a market socialism, that once they embraced the market on some level, the dynamics just kept driving the process of reform all the way until it was completely lost. And what you had was, instead of the markets helping planning, you had the market dominating planning. You had private dominating the state, and you had foreign dominating domestic, both in firms and orientation of production. So how did it happen? Kind of briefly. 1978 to 83 was the first phase. And Deng Xiaoping said, we're just going to pick some selected state enterprises, and we're going to let them fire workers, close down inefficient plants, sell surplus products at unregulated prices, whatever they could get in the market, and retain some of the profits. But we're just going to do it at select state enterprises, give them that freedom. And from the very beginning, he also tried to attract foreign investment. And one of the reasons is, if you're going to marketize, one of the critical things you have to do is allow market labor relations. If the idea of markets are that you're going to shift production to where demand and supply is in terms of profits, You have to be able to move workers. You have to fire workers. You have to hire workers. You have to have a labor market. And because he knew there would be resistance within the state sector, bringing in foreign capital was always a very important part of this strategy. Right from the beginning, they called it, they called foreign capital schools of market behavior, and that it was always a very critical and understood part. Well, what happened very quickly was that when the state enterprise managers saw that they had these opportunities, they started shoveling lots of goods to unregulated prices, sell it at unregulated prices, and they started laying off workers. And the result was you started to get inflation. Workers' wages weren't going up, so workers were losing in terms of purchasing power, and there was layoffs as these state managers tried to take advantage of boosting their own profits. So workers were very angry and started resisting this process, and the state became very worried. And so after literally about 3 years, it brought a halt to it. Put the economy, slowed the economy down, ended all reforms, brought prices down, kind of backed off, and all the while was sort of evaluating. And the evaluation made was that the reason that this didn't work was that there wasn't enough competition. There needed to be more market stuff, because if there was more markets, then if prices were high, more people would be producing and bring down prices. And if there was competition, then if there were layoffs here, new firms would arise and they would hire those workers. And so the problem was, from the party's point of view, was, well, we didn't do enough of it, so we have to do more. So in 1984, they made a major big push into the market. And what they basically, in the past, up to that point, every time a firm got any money, it automatically passed it to the state, and the state would then take the money and decide how much money to give to different firms. The firms themselves really hadn't retained any earnings. They were part of a centrally planned process. What the state said in 1984 is that state firms will now not receive any money from the central government. They will have to earn their money, and if they want to do more, they have to borrow money from state banks. But if they make some profits, they can keep it, and then they'll pay also a tax to the central government. But the central government will no longer receive all the money and automatically give money to the state enterprises. State enterprises would now be some kind of independent operating agents having to survive on their own revenue and state loans. Okay, but to make that work, of course, the state had to free up prices. Otherwise, how do you encourage the firms to kind of produce where they want to produce? There has to be free prices that will move up and down so that companies can respond to these price signals. And also, they said that from now on, this was in 86, states should now hire workers on a contract basis, which would mean that there would be temporary employment. It was no longer lifetime employment. And these contract workers would no longer get what the other state workers had gotten, which is lifetime employment, housing, health care, social benefits. So there was like a two-tier labor situation where, because state firms, if they're going to respond to market prices and shift resources and depend on profits, have to be able to have a labor force that's more flexible. So rather than take on the existing one, all new hires were now to be contract workers. And then they coupled that with a major commitment to support private enterprise and to expand the role of foreign companies now to be able to produce for the domestic market as well as to export and to allow more wholly owned foreign companies rather than just joint ventures. So this went on, and very quickly problems developed again. And some of the problems are ones you can imagine. All the state firms said, wow, we can now make money. So they went to the state banks and they borrowed a ton of money and started building factories and, new markets. And the state banks were encouraged to lend them money. And so they all start overbuilding. And in their demand for goods and services, a lot of them had to be imported. So it started to create a huge trade deficit for China. And because they were demanding all these goods and services to build new industries to make profits, prices started to rise. And so pretty soon the state companies got into a position where they had all these debts, but they weren't necessarily making profits. But the state government wanted this to succeed, so it kept encouraging the banks to lend these state firms more and more money, because if they stopped and these state firms went bankrupt, there'd be a lot of unemployment and a lot of unhappy workers, and that would create problems. So the state banks just kept loaning money. Adding to the problems of the state firms was that these new private firms that came in to encourage them, while state firms paid about a 30% tax on profits, private firms paid a 11% tax on profits, and they didn't have any social obligations to their workers. So they were in a much better place to make profits. And the result was that they started to steal market share from state firms, and that began to lower state firm profits even more, which made it harder for them to pay back their loans. And then as private sector started to become a reality, many of the state managers would start stealing from the state firms in one fashion or another to support their own newly established private businesses. So what they might do is sort of sell to their own businesses resources at very cheap prices, and then they could sell at the unregulated market price, or they would actually steal resources and shift them over to the private businesses. And again, this began a process of corruption that really began to undermine the state sector businesses. This created another set of problems, because the state now no longer gets any revenue except its tax money. And because the state sector firms are now suffering from low profits because of managers stealing and because of the private sector and the overproduction, the state sector, the central government isn't getting very much money. And now we have all these workers who are contract workers and private workers who don't have any unemployment, no health insurance, no pensions, no nothing. They're demanding these services that the state said it would provide, but the state has no money to provide it. So the state is now beginning to run into a fiscal crisis where it's got all these obligations but not very much revenue. So the state starts taxing away almost all the profits, the central government, of these state firms to try and get what it can, because it doesn't want to tax the private firms and it doesn't want to tax the foreign firms because it's trying to encourage them. So you get a situation like this. In 1978, 35% the revenue that the state generated was equal to about 35% of GDP. Okay, by 1996, it was down to 11%. Because more and more of the activity in the country is now not being taxed, doesn't flow into the state sector. By 1995, the private sector accounted for 40% of economic activity, but paid only 11% of the tax payments. So you have a situation now where more and more people are not covered by the state programs and are demanding them, and yet the state sector is being squeezed by all these things and running into crisis, and now the state banks are in trouble because as the state firms, all their money is being taxed away, they're not able to pay their debts. The central government is having a fiscal crisis now. It doesn't have enough revenue to cover its obligations. So we get to the third phase in 1991. What's the state do? We have to start selling off state industry. So it begins to say, if we sell off our state industries, we'll raise revenue to cover our obligations. And if we don't own the state industry, then if private companies take it over, then they'll bring in money and they won't have to borrow from the banks, and that will limit the problems of the banks. Well, who's going to buy all these state enterprises? This is where foreign capital comes in. A lot of them are fairly big enterprises. So the state begins to privatize the state sector, selling increasingly to foreign capital. And remember, China's running this trade deficit, so foreign capital is seen as very important because it will be much better to export than Chinese firms, right? And third, they're seen as most likely to provide the efficiency and overcome the resistance of state sector workers who are very unhappy with what's going on. So over the course of the 90s, the state starts selling off and most of its industry, and introducing even stock ownership in the industry it continues to hold. So the end result is that where the state sector in 1995 produced about 70% of output. By 2002, it goes from 70% to 30%. In 2002, foreign capitalists operating in China are now producing 34% of the country's output. They are now producing foreign capital, a greater share of output than the state sector. And because foreign capital is increasingly interested in exporting, by 2002, 2003, 2004, about from in the 90s, maybe China exported about maybe 10 or 15% of its GDP. Now it's about a third. And multinationals now produce about 55 to 60% of those exports. So this is sort of a slippery slope, where the Chinese state, starting with just, you know, we're going to make these minor reforms, each time they created problems, since they were committed to the market, it just sort of led. And, of course, every time the Chinese state started reforms, new class constituencies developed. So you now have a private sector who says, yeah, we want more of this. You now have state managers who are stripping assets and doing their own things, and you now have foreign capital that's there in alliance with state capital. And so you get these new social classes that keep pushing for more and more of these reforms and become this constituency until pretty soon you have an economy that's now dominated by foreign capital, dominated by exports, and dominated by the logic of the market. So from my point of view, what you have is really a capitalist economy, still with a sizable state, but no longer a state that really is in control of this process. But really now very much integrated into the market. So what does all that mean in terms of then how the Chinese economy is functioning? Okay. Since 1978, the Chinese economy has grown at an average rate of about 9.5%. That's the fastest in the world. It's three times the rate of growth of the United States, faster than any other country. To give you just a little feeling for it, China is now the fourth largest industrial producer. This is, I'm just reading a quote from The Economist. China is the fourth largest industrial producer in the world after the U.S., Japan, and Germany. It's the leading producer in terms of output in more than 100 kinds of manufactured goods. It makes more than 50% of the world's cameras, 30% of the world's air conditioners and televisions, 25% of the washing machines, 20% of the refrigerators, more than 50% of the world's toys. It sells about 60% of the world's apparel, 20% of textiles, 85% of bicycles. I mean, just huge. And as I mentioned to you, one of the keys to this growth has been foreign investment. In 1990, China got about $3.5 billion of investment from multinational corporations. 1994, that one year, it was $33.8 billion. In 2003, it was $53.5 billion. China got more foreign investment that year than any other country in the world. And 2004, it rose to about $60 billion. Interestingly, China is the only country in East Asia that's continuing to get more and more foreign investment. Other countries in East Asia are either seeing their investment fall or it's just staying the same, because all the investment that was going to East Asia more generally, like Korea, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, Taiwan, is now all going to China. Foreign producers are dominating. I sort of mentioned that. Okay, without going into the details here, mainstream economists and even left economists, I have to say, who don't, I think, look at this very carefully, are saying, okay, the argument is if China is now this huge producer and is producing all these exports by foreign capital, workers are obviously have a very good reason to worry about this, this country that's doing all this. But mainstream economists say, no, there's no need to worry about this. And the reason is because of the very unique nature of China's growth. And left economists actually don't look very much at sort of the overall structure and the functioning of the global economy and China in it. They just see China's growing very fast, and those who like that celebrate it, right? But at least the mainstream economists are trying to say, well, what does all this mean? And they have an argument as to why workers shouldn't worry about it. And here's the argument that they make. I'm going to quote from the Economist, which is a very conservative British publication. And the Economist and mainstream economists give two reasons why China's rise as a major export power, foreign capital, is not a problem. The first is, for such a big country, China is unusually open to trade and investment. This year, and this is 2004 article, the sum of exports and imports of goods and services is likely to reach 75% of China's GDP, far more than in any other big countries. America, Japan, India, and Brazil, the figure is 30% or less. So imports and exports as a percent of GDP in China, actually this last year, reached 80%. Very, very high, which means a lot of China's activity is tied to global activity. And at its peak, Japan's trade reached only 32% of its GDP. The second feature is that Chinese manufacturers have access to almost unlimited supply of cheap labor, says The Economist. 200 million workers can be pulled from the countryside. You know, they'll work for nothing. Okay, so why are these two things so great for the world economy? The argument is that because China is so open to foreign investment and so many cheap workers, all this foreign investment will come in and will employ these cheap workers producing exports. But because China is such an open system, it will be importing so many goods and components to produce these that it will be driving a virtuous cycle of growth. China's low-cost labor will be producing goods cheap for all of us, and because it's a relatively less developed country, it will be needing all this technology, all these components, all this investment, and so we, in other countries, can produce all these goods and services for China. And the result is that we'll be getting the benefits of these cheap consumer goods, and we'll be, instead of producing those cheap consumer goods, we'll be moving upscale to produce more sophisticated goods, which the Chinese need to produce their cheap goods, and there'll be this kind of virtuous cycle where everyone will gain if we have economies that are open to these global dynamics. And that's why mainstream economists say that countries have to be prepared to reorient their production to mesh with China, and that's why we need these WTOs and open global systems so that all this new investment can take place in this sort of virtuous way. And they argue that developed capitalist countries will gain, third world gain, other countries in the third world will gain, East Asia will gain, everyone just needs to kind of adjust. They've looked at, a lot of these economists who make these arguments have looked at East Asia, and they say that's really the key. And it's really the key because countries like Korea and Thailand and Malaysia and Taiwan, they were all economies that grew by producing exports thanks to foreign investment. So they should be the ones who would be most threatened by China. And if we can show that they're not threatened, then clearly it's a win-win, all of us will gain. Some workers may lose out in the short run, but the economies will readjust and everything will be fine. So the first thing is to just look at the data. And I'm just going to kind of try not to give you too many numbers, but, and if you miss some numbers and want to get them, don't hesitate to ask, okay? But if you want more numbers, I brought lots of tables here, and I can give you the numbers behind the trends, okay? The Chinese have definitely reoriented their economy to exports, and who they export to are the European Union and the United States, primarily Japan third. China in 1990 had about 60% of its exports, which were small, to East Asia. It went from 60 down to 30 by the year 2000. So it's reoriented itself. Not only does it export more, but it doesn't export to East Asia anymore. It exports to the United States and the European Union and then Japan. And so this means that all these other countries who used to export to the United States are now faced with this enormous challenge of this Chinese juggernaut that's selling all these things. It turns out, and just to give you a feeling for the significance of this, I did want to... if you take these three groups of countries, one's called the newly industrialized economies of Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, Hong Kong, kind of somewhat developed, and the other is the Southeast Asian countries of Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines, lower level, and then China, three separate groups. And you look at the relative strength of China now competing with these other two groups in the U.S. is pretty amazing. In 1989, China provided 7% of all the exports of computers, peripherals, and semiconductors to the U.S. as a percentage of the three groups' exports to the U.S. The middle group of Koreas and Taiwans and everything had 72%, and the Southeast Asian countries had 21%. China's share went from 7 in 1989 to 24% in 2002 of the group's total. Apparel and footwear from 36 to 69. Household goods from 24 to 67% of the three groups total. Recreational equipment, 38% of the total to 84%. Home entertainment equipment, 19% to 58%. And the other countries, therefore, have had to greatly reduce their share of these markets. China's is really gangbusters in there. And the same is true. So clearly, this is the big a major problem. But what's happened to these other countries? Well, in line at some level with the mainstream explanation, these countries have all reoriented where they sell. They're not selling to the United States and Europe and Japan much anymore, but they're now all selling to East Asia and especially to China. And moreover, if you look at their exports, these other countries now, sort of like the mainstream predicted, they're all now exporting more upscale goods. So like if you look at high technology goods, Singapore had about 40% of its exports high technology in 1990. That rose to 60%. The Philippines from 16 to 70%. Malaysia from 35 to 60%. This is all from 1990 to 2000. Okay. Thailand. So it sounds like, gee, they're all, I could just read you them all, they're all upgrading their exports. So isn't this proof that China is now dominating there, and all these other countries have reorganized, selling to China and each other, and they're all selling more advanced goods, so everybody must be succeeding. And that's basically the argument. I could give it to you in more detail, but that's probably it. And you can see by looking at the data that every one of these countries now runs a huge surplus in its trade with China, where they used to run, in some cases, deficits. Now they're running like $40, $50 billion surplus trading to China, and all in kind of medium and high technology goods. So they've all reoriented their trade. Okay, what's the underside to the story that I think sort of shows that this doesn't really, isn't nearly as good as people would say? And the key is that China is not being changed by itself, and these other countries are not being changed by themselves. What's happening is that multinational corporations are restructuring China and East Asia and the U.S. and Japan in a overarching global production networks. They're establishing these production networks that are simultaneously restructuring all these economies in ways that are, in fact, very destructive. And I want to go through and sort of show you why that's the case. And so when we actually start to talk about what's happening in China, what's happening here, what's happening there, there's a very common dynamic that's at work, that workers in all these countries are being subjected to. And that it's that dynamic that we have to bring to the fore when we talk about what's going on in the world economy. Okay. Every one of these countries is now, in terms of exports and imports, relative to GDP, rising. So more and more of the economic activity of every country, China and all of East Asia, more and more of that activity is tied to global activity, which means it's not tied to the domestic economies anymore. It's responding to either production elsewhere or needs elsewhere. And significantly, more and more of both the imports and exports are parts and components. Only recently did the UN start issuing some very good data, dividing trade and manufactured goods into final products and parts and components. And the data is very revealing about what's happening. Almost every country in the region, and I would say probably most of the countries in the world, but I'm just focusing on East Asia right now, the imports and exports are increasingly becoming parts and components. So, for example, from 1992 to 2000, Thailand's exports that are parts and components went from like 20 to 40%. And its imports went from 20 to 45% parts and components. Philippines, in 1992, 29% of its exports were parts and components. Now 64% of its exports are parts and components. Singapore, 28 to 50%. Korea, from 17 to 35%. Same on the import side. Countries are exporting and importing more and more parts and components. And what's happened is that China is the only country that is no longer exporting, that is not exporting parts and components. China has become a final production base for assembly of parts and components that are produced everywhere. China's imports now are very, very high parts and components. And if you look at the trade of these East Asian countries with China, it's quite amazing. Malaysia, in 1992, only 4% of its exports to China were parts and components. Now it's 50%. Thailand was only 6.8%. Now it's 54%. The Philippines, 1.8% to 82%. Korea, 8% to 30%. Everybody is now exporting more to China, more parts and components. China is the only country whose exports are final products. All of these countries are being knit together in an overarching production structure that is being dominated by multinational corporations. And what's happening is not only are they doing parts and components, but it's in a very narrow set of electronics and electrical equipment. So more and more of the activities of these countries are being reduced to parts and components of fewer and fewer products that are being traded around East Asia, finally making their way to China, where they're then exported to the U.S. So what's happened is that there's so much trade going on among East Asian countries of parts and components that many people have said, oh, East Asia is now this stable group. They just trade with each other. They're now independent of the United States. But all of that trade is parts and components. And when you look at the percent of final products that are sold within the region or outside the region, the percentage of final products that are sold outside the region is growing every year. So where maybe 5 years ago only 50% of final products were sold outside the region, now it's about 60 or 65%. But if you just look at the trade figures, you'd say, oh, 80% of East Asia's trade is just within East Asia. But that's because parts and components are flying around as multinational corporations have set up these complex production webs. And the region as a whole now is more tied together and more dependent on exporting outside than they ever were before. And China's role is as the final production base. And what that means then is that workers in all these countries are being tied here and are being subject, in a sense, to a competitive struggle with China's working conditions setting the base within which governments in all these other countries have to compete to try and keep their own parts, production, and export viable. So workers throughout the region are being pitted against each other, both within the same company and across companies, to keep going here. And the reason this is very destructive, as you can imagine, is one, what we have now is a process where a growing share of every country's economic activity is now disconnected from national needs. It's controlled by imports and exports of parts and components. which are tied to an overall production logic that's disconnected. And two, it means that the region now is even more tied together and dependent on exporting than they ever were before. And who are they exporting to? Well, us in this country and Europe. And the question is that forever? I mean, if we reach some point because of a recession or a declining dollar where we can't keep growing in terms of the imports we take, that's going to reverberate down the entire supply chain and affect every East Asian economy. So it's very unstable. And the third is, of course, it pits workers against each other in a process where very little of the value added is actually remaining in any country. And the ability of capitalists to move production from one country to another and move value added here and move value added there means that even if China raises its currency and it becomes a little less competitive, these production networks can kind of shift in one fashion or another, but it creates a very, very super competitive nature. And because now they're so export dependent, of course, the way you maintain your competitiveness is to keep your workers' wages down. And if you keep your workers' wages down, then there's no domestic market, so of course you become more export oriented. China's domestic consumption used to be 50% of GDP, now it's 40% of GDP. It's a self-reinforcing process, that the more you try and compete to be in these value production networks, the more you have to repress worker wages, the less domestic demand, the more you become export competitive, export-oriented, the more dependent you are on this foreign capital. So you have this entire process moving, which means that the countries in this region are moving further and further away from any kind of vision of national development, any kind of, a rooted process. And the Chinese workers are just as much a part of this as the Korean workers, the Thai workers, and Americans. Let me, if I can, just take a little bit of time to talk about the situation within China and in the United States that results from this to kind of flesh this out a little bit. So maybe about 10 more minutes, and then we can open it up to questions or comments or whatever. Well, the first thing to say is that, given China's success, you would think, well, it must show up someplace. If China's taking everyone's jobs and they're so successful, we should see Chinese working class really enjoying things. That would be the logical thing, right, if there's success someplace. The fact is that Chinese workers are really, really facing very, very bad conditions. They keep getting worse. Urban unemployment rates, although they're officially supposed to be about 4%, are anywhere, no one knows for sure, from 15 to 25%. And the difference is that the Chinese government does not include in their unemployment statistics either laid off state sector workers or the 100 to 200 million workers who come from the countryside but don't have residency permits in the urban areas. So when they don't have jobs in the urban areas, they're not counted as unemployed. Okay? When you include those people, even the International Monetary Fund says, it's probably 15%. Other conservative analysts say it's probably like 25% urban unemployment. The state sector workers have really, really been hard hit. As I mentioned to you, state sector employment and, privatization, everything has really fallen. I just read yesterday, I had a different statistic. This one was so mind-boggling to me, I think I'm just going to share it. The government set up a three-tier process for state sector workers. They have laid off about 30 million state sector workers in the last 5 or 6 years, as the state sector has just collapsed downward. The three tiers were, for 3 years, you remained part of your firm, and you went to a retraining center, and you got paid part of your wage. At the end of 3 years, if you couldn't find a job, you shifted into an unemployment program, which you could get for 2 years, and you got less money. At the end of those 5 years, if you couldn't find a job and really had no money, you channeled into their kind of welfare system. It's called minimum living standard, something like that. I can't remember the exact title. That paid about, I think if the average wage, let's see, let me make sure I get this exactly right. if the average wage of a Chinese worker was 1,300 yuan, this poverty thing, as opposed to 1,300, was 154. Okay, that was their welfare poverty. Out of the 30 million laid off state workers, 22 million are earning that amount. That means 22 million out of the 30 million laid off state workers have not been able to find jobs and are down now making that low amount of money. Okay, many of them are in parts of the country that had been built up before, and it now, because the coastal area is where all the foreign capital is coming from, they face no future. And when you read sometimes about 20, 40, 50,000 workers in these big industrial areas shutting down, you know, rail or other, they're demonstrating for housing, they're demonstrating for pensions. They have nothing. They're desperate. Yes?
You know, offhand, that's 30 million and 22 million out of how many in the state sector and how many is that out of total employment, you know, or total workforce?
The total state urban workforce is 30% of the population, but let me, I can tell you pretty easily, I think. Let me look one more second here, otherwise I'll find it in a minute or two. I know I have it here on the table. The percentage. Let me look a little bit later. I've got it somewhere in here, because I don't remember exactly. But the decline, what I do know is that the decline over the last 7 years, in the that figure I gave you is the decline from, over, I think it was the last 5 years, was 30 million. No, it had to be longer. It must have been 7 years. The decline in state sector employment. Okay. Okay, so they're being hit very hard, and there are lots of these demonstrations. The state has basically been able to handle those because they don't affect current production. These people are laid off, and they're very desperate, and they do a lot of militant things, but they're not affecting, and they're not in the centers where there's really a lot of production going on, so they're not strikes, you know, literally in that sense. And the state isolates them, keeps the news from going around, tries to buy them off a little bit, sends in police, and has generally been able to keep them somewhat localized, even though, you know, you could have 40,000 workers mobilized and demonstrating, but it doesn't spread that much. And for many years, they were able to kind of get away with that. What's happened recently is that the foreign capital, and particularly in the coastal areas where foreign capital and domestic and state enterprises still continue, have been untouched by these problems. What's happened in the last few years is, but particularly actually the last year and now this year, is that there are now strikes in these foreign sectors and, to a lesser extent, the state sector. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has just done attempting to figure out what China's wage is, because they want to add it to their study. And according to their preliminary work, they found out that China has 38 million city manufacturing workers, and the 30 million that this consultant could find data on, she found that they earned an average of $1.06 an hour with benefits. There were 71 million suburban and rural manufacturing workers who earned an average of 45 cents an hour with benefits for a, what they called a blended 64 cents. Mexico, which has the lowest earning for manufacturing workers in the OECD, has $2.48 an hour. In the key areas where the exports are produced in China, like in Guangdong, which is in the Pearl River Delta, where one-third of all of China's exports are produced, workers there have not had a wage increase in 10 years. And according to studies, they have, given inflation has been somewhat high, their average pay has fallen by as much as 30%. Okay, these are the workers producing the exports. Moreover, even the Chinese government admits that 70% of the migrant workers who have come in, 70%, are not even being paid their full wages. Companies just don't pay them. What's been happening finally now is that these workers are actually going on strikes. And some of them are beginning to demand their own unions. And they say, well, you have to be in the All-China Federation of Trade Unions. Okay, charter us. Right? And the Chinese government is now extremely fearful of what's going on because these are now strikes that are affecting foreign export production. It's a whole new development. A lot of women involved, a lot of text messaging. Women sit at their work and they text message and they organize across factories. From friends I know who travel in from Hong Kong who do work with them. They're very knowledgeable about the news. They know what's going on. So at this point, the state sector workers and the migrant workers have very little contact, however. And there's not much of kind of any sort of cross-regional connections, but within regions, there are things going on. Local governments do nothing because the reform system meant that local governments are now often joint venture, make their money by these foreign investors coming in, and the last thing they want to do is scare them off. And so local governments do very little. The central government does get worried about this, but it can't control what the local governments do very much anymore. And so workers are really finding themselves on their own, and two things are happening. Not only strikes, but people are no longer coming from the countryside anymore. And there are now growing labor shortages. And in some of the cheaper goods, there's now talk about moving production to Vietnam or Bangladesh, because the Chinese workers, even with these wages, are now, this is global capitalism, right? Can't even tolerate those. Massive, you know, China never had a national healthcare system. It had healthcare in the rural areas through the communes and healthcare in the urban areas through the state enterprises. When the communes were dissolved and the state enterprises were done, there's no longer a national healthcare system. People are now forced to pay for it. Something like out-of-pocket expenses in healthcare rose over the last 10 years from 16% to 60%. Chinese workers don't have the healthcare anymore. Healthcare problems, infant mortality rates are on the rise. There's been a complete decline in healthcare conditions. China was widely celebrated by the World Bank for having lowered poverty like by 400 million people from 78 to the 2002. These figures are very suspect, and a lot of it had to do with the gains up to 78. Even Chinese figures in the World Bank now admit that last year 800,000 new people entered poverty level, and we're talking about less than $80 a year, right? That's the Chinese poverty level, and the rate of poverty is growing at that level. People don't go to education anymore. Schools are collapsing. Hospitals are collapsing. I could read you all these statistics, but I don't want to take the time to do it. Moreover, within China itself, the Chinese state is trying very hard to build national champions of some of their state firms. And basically, they have failed to do it. And one of the reasons is that they have allowed foreign capital in so quickly, so early, that in all the high-tech sectors, their foreign capital that basically produces all these things. And the only successes that the Chinese state has had have been with raw material producers and primary commodity producers. They have not succeeded in making profitable any high-tech firm or anything else. So you have an economy where lots of money is being generated in joint ventures. The party now has officially capitalists in it. Model workers on Labor Day are celebrated, are capitalists now. And the whole push is for tied to this thing where you have a relatively small numerically, percent-wise, but numerically large growing elite with differences now between rural and urban bigger than in sub-Saharan Africa. Massive numbers of people in the main cities who are living as if the United States with suburban kind of lifestyles where, you know, masses of number of people now. And even though, you know, this $1 a day poverty figure that was, you know, supposed to be 400 million people were raised above it. You know, it used to be that you didn't have to pay for health care or education or housing. And what's happened now is that people may get a little more money than a dollar a day, but they can't afford any health care, housing, or education. So are they really better off? And the answer clearly is no. Let me move very quickly to the United States and make my final kind of point here, because I don't want to keep going on too long. I'm going to skip South Korea and talk about that, and talk about the U.S. real quickly. I said this was a global thing, and actually let me just cut to what I think is a critical point here, and then maybe we can touch on other things in the conversation. We all know that obviously U.S. capital is also benefiting. Walmart is buys something like 20% of all the imports from China in the United States, about $18 billion. Just Walmart, General Motors, Motorola is all sort of doing things. I think probably the most revealing thing to say about this situation and what this represents comes from a study done by two people. Stephanie Luce and Kate Bronfenbrenner. And they did a study in 2004 for the U.S. Congress where they looked at job shifts that were tied contractions and openings from the U.S. to other countries. In English speaking, they surveyed the entire English-speaking press, and they tried in the first quarter of 2004, and they did it for the first quarter in 2001. Every time they discovered a company announcing they were reducing jobs to move them, they tried to see where they moved it to and how many were moved, and if it happened within that quarter, even with announced and completed later, or completed, they counted it. But they had to find it somehow, initiated or completed in that quarter. And they had done this in 2001, they did in 2004. And they found some amazing differences between the 2001 and 2004. As you can imagine, there were lots of closures and openings to China, but still more closures and openings to Mexico. Okay? Maybe not surprising for U.S. capital. What they found that was so amazing, though, was that in 2001 you had a closing and an opening. In 2004, you had a closing and multiple openings. Not only were the number of closings and openings higher, like maybe three times as high, but now 50% of the openings were in multiple countries, not just U.S. to Mexico or U.S. to China, but now increasingly U.S. to Mexico and China. And what they discovered was that U.S. firms were using a nearshore and offshore strategy. They would pick a place close, Central America, South America, mostly Mexico, pick a place far, mostly China. What they also discovered in looking at this, even though the U.S. was their focus, European firms were doing the same thing, Eastern Europe and China, and Asian firms were doing the same thing, except for them, China was the nearshore and the offshore location. And the reason that China looms so large is because it is the production base for multinationals from all these regions. But we have competition. So U.S. multinationals are structuring Mexico and China. European, Western Europe are using East Europe and China. Asia is using China. And because East Asia is much more export-oriented and China's there, China, of course, is much, much bigger, but it's also picked up because it's part of this broader cross-cutting set of multinational production networks. And so what we really have is that this whole world is being increasingly restructured in this way by multinational corporations. And the way to really kind of grasp the commonality of this is to look at the two sides of this, China and the United States. And as I mentioned to you, that the United States has lost 3 million manufacturing jobs, China's lost 15 million manufacturing jobs. The United States has lost jobs in textiles, 200,000 jobs in the last 7 years. China's lost 1.8 million jobs in textiles. China has lost jobs in 26 of their 38 industrial sectors. It's a very similar restructuring process of workers being pitted against each other, forced to work harder, more capital intensive, in a process that's leaving workers in China subject to the very same processes as workers in the United States, as workers in Korea, as workers in Mexico who are losing capital to China. So what do we say about this here? One is capitalism remains a very, very dynamic system. And because it's so dynamic, and as it moves around in different historical periods, some countries seem to be growing. It looks like it's working. And it fools people because this is success here in Mexico. These, not now, but it's China now. So, and we keep thinking because of this rapid movement, at any moment in time, it looks like one country is a success until it shifts and then it's not. But all the failures are tied to the success. I mean, that's why you can't look at this from one country's point of view. It's combined with uneven development. They're all tied together. And the dynamics of it, though, are very confusing because it's not a stagnant situation. Our lives are getting worse, not in terms of the stagnation of capitalism, but because of its very dynamic. The second thing to say is China is not an attractive model. And when we encourage people to see China as a success, what we're encouraging people to say is exports are a success. Attracting foreign investment is a success. Divorce from what it means to people. Divorce from the fact that it's part of a process that's not Chinese driven. We're not talking about a powerful industrial state that's controlling. We're talking about multinational capital driving a process of restructuring. This is not a model that we would want to support for the Chinese working class. They're trying to resist it. What does it mean for progressives to embrace it? And it's certainly not a model we want other countries to follow. Finally, what we have to see is that the enemy isn't China. This is the obvious point. But in fact, the enemy is capitalism and the way it's restructuring. And the problem is that if we allow ourselves to be pitted against workers and say, the Chinese are stealing our jobs, their success is our expense, and all those kinds of things, you know, it just plays into a process that encourages and allows capital to continue pitting workers against each other. This whole Chinese East Asian process is built on exporting here. Sooner or later, we can't keep importing. When that happens, there will be a serious crisis. It will reverberate around. It does not mean capitalism will end. It means that capitalists will seek to escape the crisis on our backs even more. And the question is, at what point do we step back and see capitalism, how it's operating as a global system, not see China as our enemy, but see capitalism as the enemy, and organize to confront that and find ways of building solidarity. On that note, let me stop and then we can take some questions. So thank you very much.
Hold on, Pete, if you would. A few announcements before we begin. I'm going to send around a sign-up sheet. If anybody isn't on the sign-up sheet would like to hear about some of our other forums, please sign up. Also, kind of to pay the hall rent and help us out here, the IWW going to pass around the hat, and I appreciate anything you can put into that. And so, if we could, since we've got a lot of people here, try to make your comments fairly brief, and I'd encourage, if you ask once, wait until other people have had a chance to ask before you ask a second question. So, with that.
I'm just curious if there's any way of tracking trends, and if people have any sense of when the export market to the United States from China will be growing, like you would say you see that growth.
It's gone further than I would have thought. So I'm reluctant to say, you know, what does it mean? Because in a way, what you have is that the Chinese elite and the U.S. elite have kind of are willing to keep going for a while here. What's happened, of course, is that we're buying all their goods. We're buying lots of goods produced in China. I'm not going to say by Chinese, you know, companies, but produced in China. And their money is being reinvested here to keep exchange rates stable, which makes it profitable for them to keep exporting. And for the U.S. government to deal with that, they would have to begin to say, this is an unacceptable process. How do we restructure the U.S. economy, put limits on multinationals, rebuild domestic things? It would require the Chinese elite to say, you know, and neither elite really wants to do that, so the process keeps going. I think that it reaches a point where the U.S. trade deficit gets so great. I think last year the statistic I saw said that 75% of world savings is now being invested in the United States. Okay, it's sucking that, and this has to keep growing. At some point, you know, there's an old saying, when things can't go on forever, they won't. And I don't know where that will be. And the issue, of course, is when that stops, which I think it will, how it will play out, how people understand it, what kind of responses. But it's gone on much longer than I thought it would be, and to the extent that the U.S. and Chinese elite seem to find this as an acceptable short-term process, and neither side is doing very much about it, it's continued a lot longer than I thought it would.